In 1849, Alfred Tennyson wrote a poem, completed a poem, I should say, entitled In Memoriam, A.H.H. The poem made him famous, partly because Queen Victoria loved it. In fact, the next year she named him Poet Laureate of Britain, and he retained that, actually, through the rest of his life, became the longest serving of all the poet laureates anywhere in the world, so far as I know. And during that time, he left us works like The Charge of the Light Brigade, Half a League, Half a League, Half a League Onward, and so on, and other things that you may, if you grew up at an earlier era, have been plagued with by your high school English teacher or someone else. He left us some memorable poetry and some actually very bad poetry as well through the course of his life. And Queen Victoria actually said at one point that In Memoriam was her favorite poem, that she kept it right alongside her Bible at her bedside, and it gave her great comfort. In Memoriam was finished after 17 years of work, and it shows. It is a very long poem. I tried to read it all yesterday, and I think Carol can attest that I was falling asleep repeatedly, which actually is the overwhelming effect of the poem, is actually to put you to sleep. It's over 20,000 words, over 3,000 lines of poetry. So this is long. And in many ways, the overall effect of the poem is kind of a dreary, melancholy monotony, which may actually have been intended. Just so that you get the sense of it, maybe you can fall asleep with me. Well, let me read some of it to you. This is just breaking into, actually, early on, but sort of in the middle. O sorrow, cruel fellowship, O priestess in the vaults of death, O sweet and bitter in a breath, what whispers from thy lying lip? The stars, she whispers, blindly run, a web is woven across the sky. From out waste places comes a cry and murmurs from the dying sun. And all the phantom nature stands with all the music in her tone, a hollow echo of my own, a hollow form with empty hands. And shall I take a thing so blind, embrace her as my natural good, or crush her like a vice of blood upon the threshold of the mind? And it goes on and on and on, and mostly actually has to do with Tennyson's deep sorrow at the loss of his friend. He had a friend named Arthur Henry Hallam, who died in 1833 of a cerebral hemorrhage when Arthur Hallam was visiting Vienna. The news came to Alfred Tennyson. Hallam had been one of his closest friends and also had become engaged to Alfred Tennyson's sister. And by the way, Alfred Tennyson, of course, later became, when he was named a baronet, Alfred Lord Tennyson, which was forever confusing to me when we used to play the game Authors when I was a child. You know, why would anyone have Lord as a middle name? I had no idea. But anyway, so they get this news, and, well, Alfred Lord Tennyson does what poets do. He works out his grief by writing this poem, and writing it, and writing it, and writing it for 17 years until, in 1849, he finally completes it and becomes famous for it. So that's the story of In Memoriam, A.A.H. Turns out that there's another poem that was written in somewhat parallel circumstances. 2 Samuel chapter 1. 2 Samuel chapter 1, we'll begin in verse 19. Your glory, O Israel, lies slain on your heights. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised rejoice. O mountains of Gilboa, may you have neither dew nor rain, nor fields that yield offerings of grain. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul, no longer rubbed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the flesh of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, the sword of Saul did not return unsatisfied. Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and gracious, and in death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. How the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. How the mighty have fallen. The weapons of war have perished. Now, David is admirably economical, especially when compared with Alfred Lord Tennyson. Right? It's wonderful that he can manage to write this in just a few lines, and the poetry is, I would judge, quite a bit better in many ways. But the circumstances are in lots of ways somewhat similar. Alfred Lord Tennyson loses this dear friend of his. He does what poets do. He writes a poem. David, facing the death of Saul, who has just died, does what poets do. He writes a poem. But what's the background to this? Well, we kind of skipped over the death itself of Saul, and so we need to back up and look at it and get some background on what had actually happened to Saul. The end of 1 Samuel chapter 31, beginning at the beginning of the chapter. Now the Philistines fought against Israel. The Israelites fled before them, and many fell slain on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines pressed hard after Saul and his sons, and they killed his sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The fighting grew fierce around Saul, and when the archers overtook him, they wounded him critically. Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and run me through, or these uncircumcised fellows will come and run me through and abuse me." But his armor-bearer was terrified and would not do it, so Saul took his own sword and fell on it. When the armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he too fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul and his three sons and his armor-bearer and all his men died together that same day. When the Israelites along the valley and those across the Jordan saw that the Israelite army had fled and that Saul and his sons had died, they abandoned their towns and fled, and the Philistines came and occupied them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his armor, and they sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their idols and among their people. They put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreths and fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. When the people of Jabesh-Gilead heard of what the Philistines had done to Saul, all their valiant men journeyed through the night to Bethshan. They took down the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Bethshan and went to Jabesh, where they burned them. Then they took their bones and buried them under a tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted 7 days. This is a tragic end to a tragic life. We've been following the life of Saul actually for months now, and there's no question that from the beginning it was tragic, right? From when we first met him, this was a tragedy in the making. He was doomed almost from the start. And so we're hardly surprised that he comes to a tragic ending of this kind of, an ending that would be worthy of, you know, best of Shakespeare tragedies. You know, the put it in a play form in a drama, and at the end, what do you have? You have bodies littered on the stage in front of you, with Saul just having fallen on his sword after having begged his armor-bearer to kill him. His armor-bearer refuses, so Saul falls on his sword and dies, and then his armor-bearer looks on in despair and falls on his sword and dies, and all you need is, you know, somebody to come along and give a soliloquy to end the play there. You know, this is the perfect sort of tragic ending to this part of the story, and it actually makes a very neat sort of a division between the two major parts of this story, that is the story of Saul, which has just ended, and the story of David's kingship, which will then be beginning. So although this is a continuous narrative, this actually is the nice breaking point for it, right? And so we come to the end, and Saul is dead, and no one is surprised at how he dies, right? It's already been foretold last week, right, by this witch that he goes to. And we're not surprised for other reasons as well, because Saul was from the beginning this kind of tragic, failed leader. He failed in so many ways. He was weak, he was indecisive, he was jealous, he was unbalanced, he was in many ways the sort of awful leader that you come to the end and you say, well, who's going to mourn the death of Saul? We were all expecting it, and maybe it's good that he's out of the way. And so what comes as a surprise is not that he dies or how he dies, but David's response. And David's response comes in two parts. The first part is right at the beginning of 2 Samuel, when a messenger comes to tell David that Saul is dead. And we'll pick up the story at the beginning of chapter 1 of 2 Samuel. After the death of Saul, David returned from defeating the Amalekites and stayed in Ziklag 2 days. On the third day, a man arrived from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and with dust on his head. When he came to David, he fell to the ground to pay him honor. "Where have you come from?" David asked him. He answered, "I have escaped from the Israelite camp." "What happened?" David asked. "Tell me." He said, "The men fled from the battle. Many of them fell and died, and Saul and his son Jonathan are dead." Then David said to the young man who brought him the report, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" "I happened to be on Mount Gilboa," the young man said, "and there was Saul leaning on his spear with the chariots and riders almost upon him. When he turned around and saw me, he called out to me, and I said, 'What can I do?' He asked me, 'Who are you?' 'An Amalekite,' I answered. Then he said to me, 'Stand over me and kill me. I am in the throes of death, but I'm still alive.' So I stood over him and killed him, because I knew that after he had fallen, he could not survive. And I took the crown that was on his head and the band on his arm and have brought them here to my lord." Then David and all the men with him took hold of their clothes and tore them. They mourned and wept and fasted till evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. David said to the young man who brought him the report, "Where are you from?" "I'm the son of an alien, an Amalekite," he answered. David asked him, "Why were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of his men and said, "Go, strike him down." So he struck him down, and he died. For David had said to him, "Your blood be on your own head. Your own mouth testified against you that you said, 'I killed the Lord's anointed.'" And you have to feel for this Amalekite guy, okay? So first of all, okay, David's first response, knock off the messenger, right? But let's feel a little bit sorry for the Amalekite guy for a few minutes here, because, you know, you have to imagine what's going through his head. He's coming to David with what he is pretty sure will be good news. Saul is dead. Saul has been David's enemy. Saul has been out to kill David. He's dead. David should be happy. So he comes to David with this news, and he thinks, well, actually, I can make it a little better for myself. If I just doctor up the story a little bit and say, I'm the one who actually finished him off, then here's what happens. I get this really good place in David's court, right? He's going to reward me because I'm the one who killed his enemy. And what does he get for all of his efforts and imagination? Well, he gets knocked off rather quickly, right? So this is the first thing that happens. This is David's first response to the death of Saul, is to weep and mourn and then to knock off the messenger because he dared to kill the Lord's anointed. This comes as, well, not entirely a surprise to us because of what we've heard earlier of David, but a little bit of a surprise. The second part of the response is what we read earlier, this poem that he writes, in which he says things like, "In life they were loved and gracious, in death they were not parted, they were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery." And he not only writes this poem, he says to all the men of Judah, you've got to memorize this poem. You have to memorize this poem, and you need to be ready to sing it. In verse 17, David took up this lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan and ordered that the men of Judah be taught this lament of the bow. It is written in the book of Jashar, which unfortunately is not extant. So he writes this poem. He says everybody has to learn it. Everybody has to be ready to sing it. And we can imagine this happening at Stony Brook, right? Hey, so Carol and I, we go off to Istanbul. And, you know, 3-4 months later, the tragic news comes back to Stony Brook. Carol and Dan have been knocked off, right? And so you're all in terrible mourning over this. You know, this is a terrible thing. And so what do you do? Well, it turns out that someone with a gift of poetry like, well, say Clara. Clara, that's what happens when you appear bored in a sermon, Clara. When Clara hears this, she does what poets do. She writes a poem. And how does she begin it? This is how she begins it. Your glory, O Stony Brook, lies slain on your heights. Oh, how the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Granby. Proclaim it not in the streets of Amherst, lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised rejoice. And then she goes on and she talks about how much she will miss Pastor Brown's cream puffs and how much she will miss the sermons. And who knew that she liked the sermons after all, right? You know, and she'll say all of these things in her poem, right? This is what will happen. We can imagine this happening. And not only will that happen, but the elders will get together and say, everybody's got to memorize this poem. It's so good, right? Everybody's got to memorize this poem. This will be a new condition for membership at Stony Brook. You will memorize this poem. We'll teach it in Sunday school. The youngest children will learn to sing this poem. At every congregational meeting, we'll have a recitation of this poem. And if you think this is over the top, you know, to imagine this, well, so is David's poem. It's over the top, right? It really is. It's over the top because we know Saul, right? We've been reading about him for months. We know what he's like. We know that Saul is this failed leader. We know that he's been after David. We know that he murdered a whole town full of priests. Right? I mean, this is a bad thing to do. We know that Saul had this jealous streak, that he was mentally unbalanced. We know that he tried to kill his son Jonathan because of his relationship with David. We know all of these things about Saul. We know Saul was not a nice person, not a good person, not a good king. We know that he had this coming to him. So we know that for sure. And on the one hand, this is the Saul we know. And then, on the other hand, we have David's picture of Saul after he died, right? We have this glowing poem in praise of Saul, remembering, you know, what a mighty warrior he was, talking about how the daughters of Jerusalem will weep about the great things that he did. So we have these two rather different pictures of Saul, right? And the interesting thing to me as I think about this, we could do this with anyone. We could do it with we could do it with me. So on the one hand, right, we know that I am a sinner, that I have failed in all of these various ways, some of which can be enumerated and counted. We know that I'm at times lazy, that I hurt people with my words, that there are times when even those closest to me I've been cruel to. We know that there are times when I have simply not lived up to the promises that I've made, that I've failed in numerous ways. Right? We know that about, we know that on that one hand, I am guilty and I am unworthy. But when it comes to my funeral, I would reckon none of that's going to be said, right? Especially by my family, even though they know the worst of it. Right? At my funeral, you know, actually, all sorts of nice things are going to be said. I hope nobody reads poetry written about me. But, you know, Claire, if you want to write a poem for my funeral, you're welcome to. You really are welcome to. And I hope they let you recite it. So, you know, Bennett will probably be a nice poem, even from Clara. Right? So at my funeral, all these nice things will be said. So we, on the one hand, we have the real me, right? And I know about the real me and those people closest to me. And on the other hand, we have this picture of me that will be presented that, you know, people will try to remember me by. And this happens at almost every funeral. Right? This is a universal experience. And it happens with every elegiac poem that's ever been written, right? It happened with Alfred Lord Tennyson. I'm sure Arthur Henry Hallam was not quite so nice as he comes across in the poem. Right? But we have these two pictures. And what is it that makes the difference between those pictures, between the Saul that we really know and the Saul that shows up in David's poem, and between the me that we really know and the me that will show up in the elegies, and between you, the real you, and the you that shows up in that picture? What's the difference between them? 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Beginning in verse 4. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. The difference between the Saul of reality, we might say, or of history, and David's picture of Saul, the me of reality, and the picture of me that my family will have, is one simple thing, and that is love. It's viewed through the eyes of love, because love keeps no record of wrongs. And you say, well, how could David be so blind? But look again at his poem, right? If you read through his poem, the whole poem is colored by love. And you know what? It doesn't begin really with the love of Saul. It begins with the love, the poem doesn't begin, but the love begins with the love of Jonathan. For the sake of Jonathan, David will allow his love for Jonathan to overflow and completely color his picture of Saul, so that when he thinks of Saul and remembers Saul, he will refuse to speak in any negative way of him. He will refuse to slander him. He will refuse to say anything that would be remembered as being a slur on his character, as depicting him, really, in many ways, as he really was. He will see Saul through his love for Jonathan, and in this way, David's poem becomes a dim foreshadowing of another kind of love, and a greater love that those who know Jesus have experienced, because God, in his love for his people, looks on us, and he knows what we're really like, but then he says, for the sake of my love for my son Jesus, that love will overflow and will encompass these people who do not deserve it, and that grace will gather them into my family, and I'll see them not as they really are, but I'll see them through love that keeps no record of wrongs. And that may be the lesson from this that we need most, to ask, which reality will you live in? Will you live in the reality of who you know yourself to be in some real sense, a sinner, or will you live in the reality of how God looks at you through eyes of love and grace because of his son, Jesus Christ? That's a constant battle for the Christian. But there's also another really challenging question that arises here, and that is, how then will you view one another? How will you view one another? Will you view one another by looking at the Saul in each other? And the truth is, we do that all the time. We look at one another and we see the Saul side. We see the weaknesses. We see the sin. We see the hurt that we've been caused by that sin. We see the jealousy. We see all the things that are wrong, and we talk about them. And we slander one another. Right? Not to our faces, maybe, but behind our backs. We do that all the time. And here we can learn something from David, because David knows Saul, but has actually throughout his life, and especially in his death, refused to do that. He has refused to see him through anything but the eyes of grace and of love for the sake of Jonathan. And you know what? Why do we need to wait until one another's death in order to exercise grace for each other? You know, why wait until the funeral to say the nice things? Why wait until that point to actually show the grace of God? Because if God can look on each of you and see in you the love of his son, Jesus Christ, then why can't we look on one another and say, this is someone for whom Christ died and who God loves? Let's pray together. Oh God, we thank you that you give us throughout your word pictures of love, and we thank you that love is the centerpiece of who you are and of what you want to communicate to us. And we pray, Lord, that you'll help to make it the centerpiece of who we are and what we are to each other. Help us to long for that. In Jesus' name.